official composer. Do you see yourself having your own jingle one of these days? Like,
you're
yeah.
Writing a song.
Yeah, yeah. Will
you be having your own jingle?
Yeah, Joey actually offered to do a jingle.
A new one.
A new one, just for our campaign. Actually, a number of artists have offered to do it. One of the other things that's starting to happen, I don't know why, but I think the artistic community starting to wake up. There's an increasing number of artists, writers, and so on, who are coming in because they sense that this campaign has a very deep understanding of the creativity of the, not only the human process, of the artistic process, but the actual unusual creativity that it will take to win this election as well as to run this country. We cannot rely on tired old formulas from the past to move this country forward. We have to rely on really innovative, creative means to bring this country forward. And the Philippines is one of the most creative countries in the world. I totally know that from experience, not only among friends here and abroad. And this is why it pains me to have a decadent political system sitting on top of all this talent that cannot express itself. And this is what I want to free up. This is the talent I want to free up in this country that has been oppressed for so long. This is it. And that's why I think we owe it to ourselves to really say, this is the moment of liberation. We have to act on our highest motives. And then if people started doing that, then these higher motives will win. And can you imagine a country run on the highest motives, not on the lowest denominator of one compromise after another, which destroying the soul of the soul? That's why I feel that this is possible in this country. And if we do this for this country, we will also have quite a global impact in what we will be able to contribute to the world. And I want to turn around the image that Filipinos are nothing but corrupt people, drug addicts, traffickers, prostitutes. That's not the Filipino. This is the exploited Filipino because the political system has not really cared for the Filipino. And this is why, for me, this has to stop. And that's why it's not easy for a civil society person to be in the middle of politics, especially at the presidential level. And it's very inconvenient. But I felt that I had to do it because that voice had to be there. And it's really up for the Filipino people to respond if they really want to see this country turn a new leaf, a very different country that we can all be proud of, and rightfully so.
Okay, we have invited guest bloggers here who are also supporters of Think Perla. So it's your turn to ask a question. If you have a question to ask, come over here now.
Yeah, you mentioned about the, not just the jingle, but there's an album coming out made by all volunteers.
Okay. Next, would you like to mention that over there? since you're the one creating it? Yeah, please. Yeah, with others. You have your song in there too.
Hi, I'm Nick Celestine. I'm one of the volunteers for NIC, and I'm also one of the officers for our new political party, Pangmasa. Nick forgot to mention,
yeah,
so I'm going to tell you that we're actually creating a music album that's written by some of the volunteers, some artists that we actually were able to get over our guides or something. Some of the artists that we have are actually underground artists right now. But in the more mainstream ones or the more popular ones are Joey Ayala, and actually just this morning even Cynthia Alexander, her Joey's sister. Okay, yeah. Joey's sister. And anyway, the music album, we're planning a two-part music album because we've already have we We already have new songs that they've written. Actually, I've actually written one song too. And I've submitted it to Joey so that they might be able to arrange it. But a lot of the underground and indigenous artists are actually really very supportive. It's like they understand where Nick is coming from. And it's really that passion and love for country that he was talking about earlier, that getting all the artists involved, especially those who are very much concerned with the environment, very much concerned with what's happening to the spirit of the land. So watch out for that. It's part of our fundraising, so please support it. And if you want, if you have artist friends who want to join in, we're going to make videos, music albums, you know, all that from the underground. So watch out. Right now, I don't think I have a question because, you know.
Okay, then we'll start with the questions coming in from the online audience.
Sure.
Thank you. Can I do it from here?
Yeah.
Okay, we have a question from somebody on Twitter. What are your plans to reform in terms of education reform?
Okay, in terms of education, it's the fifth pillar of our six pillars. We call it holistic education and inner change. I think one of the most important things is both on the quantitative and the qualitative side. We have to improve the existing system of education. Concretely, for example, I think the Philippines is only now one of two left in the world that has shortened its educational system. I think we should restructure our educational system to adhere to the stages of development, natural development of the child. We are forcing the child to become adults. We're accelerating their adulthood and disrupts children of their childhood. And this has ramifications on their maturity, on their values. So what I need to say concretely, maybe kindergarten can move on until 6 or 7 years. There'll be 7-year grades, because right now there's only 6 in the lower grades. And this is starting to affect maturity of students as they enter into college and so on. I mean, this is just some of those more traditional approach. Educate teachers to be better math and science teachers, more English proficiency, where we're suffering. But for me, one of the most important is that in education, we have to reform it to catch up with the world. Basically, the world is moving towards multiple intelligent schooling system, not just a world based on IQ. Now, we have to educate the total human being, not just the head, or an aspect of the brain, which is basically IQ, linguistic and mathematical logical intelligence. We also have to educate the capacity of Filipinos to have self-mastery, or the whole range of emotional intelligence, increase their capacity to relate to other people, to do critical thinking. Existential intelligence deals with capacity of people, Filipinos, to find meaning in their lives. This is often neglected, shortchanged. We will increase existential naturalistic intelligence, the deeper appreciation of nature, especially as we move through the age of climate change and the massive environmental disasters we're facing as a nation. Musical intelligence, visual intelligence that are important to life. So a more holistic education. So aside from just improving the existing, ensuring that all the people get educated, improving teachers, we also would want to improve the actual substance of education. And then on a more structural basis, I would like to lessen the control of the state on education. I do not want the state to determine the education of this country. The best the state can provide is resources and a kind of regulatory framework, but not to actually dictate the substance of education. Because education is properly in the cultural life, and I don't want the political life to predetermine how culture should evolve. For example, if the state is biasing education towards Filipinos being a cog in the economic machine, it's an actual disservice to the human dignity of a person. because it's very important for people not only to have jobs but have to have meaningful, fulfilled lives. For example, like in Japan. Japan is the second wealthiest country in the world, but there are 100 suicides every day, or over 36,000 suicides a year, because the educational system does not educate for existential intelligence. The Japanese young people don't know what they are here for, what their priorities are. They cannot see their future in what the previous generation has done. So we need an overhaul of the educational system. The existing one, improve it, and allow most Filipinos to experience what it means to develop full human capacity. Yes.
And then also, how about those who are in prison?
Yes.
Who are in death row?
Right. Okay. The long term plan for OFWs, because in the end, the whole thing's about freedom of choice. What we can do best is to attract OFWs to stay in the country by having a vibrant economy. That is the most important medium, long-term basis, so that they don't have to go abroad. But ultimately, because they might want to seek other things, they can still go abroad, right? So, therefore, number one, it will be important for OFWs to have, with the help of the government, a full explanation, a full exposure of the potential risk and hazards, not just in terms of just potential income for them. For example, a lot of people are, there's a number of people that are suffering from physical abuse, from human rights abuse, and so on, because it's not too well followed and regulated. And of course, the government will see to it that host countries do not abuse Filipinos while they're abroad. Number two, a lot of the young people who are left behind with single parents or no parents are suffering from psychological problems as well as drug problems. We will have to address the social impact ramifications of massive Filipino overseas workers in terms of the social fabric of the country, the collapse basically of families, of communities, and so on. So there will be specific government programs there that will be introduced, enhance what is working, introduce new programs that will care for the soul of the Filipino OFW family while the families are abroad. And then number three, make sure that there's a better fit between what Filipinos have as skills and what can be found abroad. For example, you all know the phenomenon of medical doctors training as nurses because the demand is for nurses. And there's some teachers or college graduates who are ending up as domestic helpers. So kind of trying to match more in terms of where the quality of life is. But in the end, to ensure that there are, because I think some of the Filipinos are forced to go abroad because of economic reasons. If we have a vibrant economy, develop sustainable investments here, really crack out this economy after we get through the drug and corruption, decrease poverty, I think this is going to be a very interesting place to live in. And because we have other attractions aside from just economic. We have a beautiful land, beautiful people, friendly people. That's why a lot of OFWs are homesick. We should not develop a disincentive for them to actually stay here.
With your experience in microfinance help, with this OFW?
Yeah, definitely. But our experience was that the OFW families don't need microfinance. But I'm glad you asked the question, Noemi, because one of the more important things is that we will encourage OFW remittances to be spent more productively and not just in terms of consumption. In other words, just specially a kind of consumption that doesn't really lead to further investment, further empowering of the family. So the infrastructure to put in place these kinds of investment possibilities for OFWs. aside of course from the direct help of the family. We found because our microfinance operation deals with any investment anywhere from 3,000 to 50,000, OFW money can come in at the rate of 50,000 a month or more. So the help is not really needed there, but in large scale, larger scale, small, and even medium scale enterprises.
But to prevent some from leaving, right? You are giving them poverty.
Yes, but if you're handling a big family, it will not be enough. In fact, one of the realizations in microfinance is that the microfinance industry as a whole has helped to modulate, to prevent, to buffer against sudden problems of lack of cash flow. But in terms of removing from poverty, it's been a slow process. That's why part of my platform has been to introduce the concept of strategic microfinance, which means to say we want people to graduate to have higher levels of loan assistance, to higher levels of capitalization, using technologies that are dormant in the state colleges and universities that are not being used, but can be used to for the benefit of the countryside. To cite just one example, there's a huge debate in this country in the use of genetically engineered soybeans. We're importing a lot of genetically engineered soybeans from the United States. But we also have a technology that can produce mung bean sauce equally as good as soybeans using native mungo. Then it's a potential multi-billion peso industry that can be spread out into the countryside if it's properly done and managed. So that's what I meant to say. You scale up in terms of enterprises that will have thousands of potentially even millions of potential impact. Imagine substituting the whole soy sauce industry using soybeans, which is then require the use of local resources instead of soybeans imported from the United States or China or Latin America. This is what I mean to say, strategic microfinance.
Very
yeah. Right.
It seems that it's not really taking off in a larger scale.
It's actually taking off in terms of numbers. We have 3 to 4 million now receiving microfinance assistance, but the graduation from poverty
right.
is slower. This is what we have to speed up by having larger flows of capitalization for new enterprises by the people, by the poor.
Muslim economy and the long-pending agreement with the NILF. I
yes.
think I've asked this before, but for the sake of the...
Yes, I'm a proponent for renegotiating the so-called MOAD, the Memorandum of Agreement on Ancestral Domain, between the government of the Philippines and the MILF. But I would do it in a new context and in a very different context. Number one, even before the renegotiation starts, while it's happening, there would be already a reallocation of the resources of Philippine government to ARM to redress the historical imbalance of social services in ARM. ARM has the highest poverty rate, the lowest number of roads, the lowest number of electricity, and the lower number of hospitals. I mean, ARM is suffering a neglect. And meanwhile, while that was going on, of course, the government helped Ampatuan with all these private armies going on. That policy will not exist in my administration if people put in office. So we have to demonstrate the will of the government to address historical issues as well as social justice issues from the start. And that is a credible basis to negotiate, both with the MILF and the NBF. That there is this political will of government to address serious structural injustice. Starting the negotiation, I would request both parties, including government in this case and MILF, to do massive consultations among the Muslim part and of course the Christian government side, because the original agreement was secretive. And so all kinds of misunderstanding arose out of it, very little knowledge, plus some distortions in the media, and so on. So it has to be an open process. It is transparent, and then come up with an agreement. But it is clear that the conflict in Mindanao is not a religious conflict. It is really a conflict that's connected to social injustice as well as land issues. And I think it's possible to solve the problem. The third thing that I would require greater clarification is what will be the connection of the Bangsamoro juridical entity with the central national government. That has to be specified quite clearly. It was not specified in the original memorandum of agreement. So in short, I'm open with new conditions to ensure that we achieve lasting peace by addressing real concerns that people of Mindanao, especially Muslim brothers and sisters, have.
Very good, very clear.
Okay.
But what would you think if the number of years it would take to solve this?
I don't want to be presumptuous. Yeah. But I think if this is done properly, 2 years is already too long. Too long to come to a peace process. 2 years is already a long time. So this will be solved within 2 years. Because I've spoken to both sides of the MILF side and the government side that were involved in the negotiation. There's a meeting of minds on so many areas. And part of the misinterpretation, and this is what I want to also correct here, is that the Bangsamoro juridical entity is not going to be a new nation state. It will still coexist within the broad framework of the nation state of the Republic of the Philippines. This was one of the misperceptions that they're creating a state within a state. There will have to be autonomy, self-rule, as already provided for in the Constitution, in the creation of the autonomous regions of the Philippines. It's already part there. It just has to be implemented and structured in such a way that there will be a meaningful integration and harmonization of interests between the Bangsamoro people and the Filipino people as a whole.
But what about warlordism?
Yes.
How do you think that's a very big problem too? Will that be resolved in 2 years or a new generation of the warlords?
Okay. you know, the warlords exist because they're coddled by government. Okay, so it's very clear in the case of Ampatuan, that's why the royal government is dropping Ampatuan like a hot potato, but there have already been studies since 2007 specifically, showing that billions of pesos flowing into ARM was not actually being used for the benefit of the people. Now we see where it went, right? ARMs, private armies, and all of this. Now, the government has not had the political will to dismantle private armies because they use these private armies of traditional politicians for political reasons. Now, this is the advantage of an independent candidate, like myself. There, I have no backing of any political army. I'm actually going to dismantle the warlords, the private armies, and I think if we put the full brunt of the armed forces and the police and so on, discipline way, we can dismantle the private armies in less than 2 years. You know, many of the problems that seem impossible is because the people on top have actually created and worsened the problem. This is the real problem. Smuggling is a problem because their top government people are smugglers. So, when we set up a new government, from the office of the president, the cabinet secretaries, and the 3,000 or 5,000 other government leaders that will be appointed, you just appoint them the basis of integrity, track record, the same thing, the vision, you multiply it there, and be very strict. If they go towards a traditional way, they're going to be removed from office, even if they're friends. So, I think it's doable in less than 2 years because the moment the military will really run after criminal elements, and by the way, 90% of the military are really disappointed with the Arroyo government. That's why she will be playing with fire if she declares martial law.
Yeah.
So this is what I'm saying. The moment there is a real demonstrated political will to change the system, it will send signals and ramifications, and we can dismantle them. Remove the traditional private armies, the traditional politicians will be vulnerable. Okay? Because they've only been able to abuse because they have an army, private army, to reinforce against retaliation. Yeah, Jane, you have a question.
I have a follow-up question.
Yes.
How do you propose to deal with Abu Sayyaf? Because when GMA started her term, she was already very strong and said that she would, you know, she would destroy the Abu Sayyaf and all that. And she's ending her term and they're still there. How do you plan to deal with them? Number two, since you brought up GMA, how do you also plan to deal with her if she is elected as a congresswoman?
Okay, thanks for the question. First, the Abu Sayyaf. I will not tolerate any form of terrorism in the Philippines. And therefore, all military elements that are coddling a few hundred rebels are going to be dispatched. They're going to be disciplined or removed from office because the Abu Sayyaf, from our connections in Mindanao, could not really flourish if they did not have the support of the military, some rogue elements in the military. That's why they're able to continue. And many of the Muslim leaders in Mindanao tell us that the Abu Sayyaf is not Islamic. This is not a Muslim group. They're in total violation of the Quran. They're a disgrace to Islam. So they're covered that they are religious warriors, jihadists. It's just a branding and it's a useless cover for crime and terrorism. We will send feelers to Abu Sayyaf to disarm because we are going to address the radical poverty that created Abu Sayyaf. The radical poverty and injustice, some of the historical injustices that created the Abu Sayyaf. So, and then in connection, just to finish answering the question, how will we deal with GMA? First of all, during this campaign period, in my sorties in Pampanga, I will try to clarify to the Pampangueño, to people potentially supportive, that you are harboring a major disaster in the making if you put Arroyo back. A president who's so unpopular, who for me is illegal, because I really believe that the Agarcy thing is unresolved, and somebody who's totally abused a lot of Filipinos all these years. If you're going to elect another person like that in office, there's something wrong, really wrong with your brain, or wrong with your own love for this country. How can you allow somebody to get re-elected whose clear intent is to then capture power again as prime minister in the attempt to change the constitution to a constitutional assembly? It's very clear. That's the reason why she's running. So even before there, and let's say she succeeds, then we will have a very interesting time because if she's there in Congress and in the executive branch, we've in a sense changed positions. She knows the powers of the presidency. The only thing that she did, she really abused it to the hilt and even went beyond crossing boundaries between the legislative and the judicial. So there will be a constant, the office of the president will become an office to actually then argue against any transformation of government, especially with Arroyo around, trying to capture the prime minister's position in a change of government. I'm really passionate about this because I think she's really a traitor to this nation. I mean, some very strong words.
So that means you're not for charter change?
I'm open to charter change.
Oh, you are?
Via a constitutional convention maybe 3 years after the elections. Not as a kind of thing you immediately do it. You're going to do instill instability. People's minds, well, you know, you're trying to start off with a new government, also you're talking about changing the form of government. So maybe 3 years into the line when there's no political season in connection with the leadership at the presidential level. And by the time people are going to see a very different kind of government, they might change their minds. but maybe only require changes in very specific areas.
But why would you want to change it? What is wrong with the present system?
So, for example, I think the office of the president has too much powers. So I'm going to be in a kind of position where I will actually try to reduce those powers of influence, so that the kind of influence that GMA has had will not happen again. On the other hand, we also have to introduce the notion of the responsibility of a local government unit to the larger whole, finding a proper balance between the sense of a nation state, a nationhood, and a sense of the control. For example, the control of funds. I don't think it has to pass through the office of the president. The internal revenue allotment is being now used as a form of control. That's just one concrete example. Those funds should go directly, without any question, to the local government unit, and to extract accountability there, we should make sure that mayors are also accountable for those funds. So there's a kind of check and balance. But to use that as the control of what she did for all these years, you notice in the Garci crisis, the only support she got were from the elected mayors because she controlled the IRA. Yeah.
I just want to ask this question because it's being used as a campaign line for some candidates.
What is being used? IRA?
Not now.
Internal Revenue Allotment?
Not really. This anti-GMA thing.
Yes.
Because people don't understand that, you said it, people don't understand the historical lessons that need to be learned of People Power 1 and People Power 2.
Right.
After the bad government is turned, there is no vision and everything's in disarray. We have changed from Marcos to Aquino, and then we ousted Estrada, then we got an even different worst president, Arroyo. So how will you be different?
Okay.
From all of these presidents?
This is a fantastic question for me because I'm so glad you brought it up.
Yeah.
I'm sure that we did not talk about it beforehand.
No, I saw it in your new politics. What is new politics and what is new politics? Because, you know, people are confused. We need this person because, you know, it's the opposite of GMA. So what makes you different?
Okay, the first thing about People Power 1 and People Power 2, and this is a very important historical lesson. First, of course, appreciate what it did, for example, restoring a sense of democracy from the dictatorship. But at the same time, it also showed us, especially clearly in People Power 2, that if a country is mobilized against something, not for something, then the agenda after the turnover of government under the collapse of a dictatorship or bad government, you don't know where you're going to go. Because all the energy was focused against in removing somebody. There's no vision. And I know this firsthand because during People Power 2, one of my tasks was to convene and to actually create the agenda of the future once Estrada's gone. And you know what? Very little interest from all the groups that participated.
What was your vision?
The vision is very similar to my platform. And this is the point. It's easier to mobilize a kind of hatred against something rather than to mobilize again as a kind of inspiration for a new vision about a new country. This is very different. So that's why
anti-GMA.
No, the GMA is just standing on the way of
you're
a vision.
Not the opposite of GMA.
No, the point here is that this country can be something else. A much better country than it has been in the past. We have to outline this vision. That's why the beginning point for me of the new politics is a vision of what this country can be. And I often cite in some contexts the study done, a very thorough study done by European sociologists, and it's encoded in a book called, documented in a book called Image of the Future by Fred Pollack. It's a study of 5,000 years of Western civilization, the ups and downs of Western civilization. And one of the key elements when they try to discover what causes the collapse of a nation, is it economics? Is it ecological collapse? Is it political, military? What was it? The number one factor that created and destroyed nations is either the presence of a positive image of the future or the lack of it. Clearly, the Philippines has been kind of shipwrecked because it has no positive image of the future. So how are you going to galvanize aspirations of millions of Filipinos if you don't know where this country is going? So that's why for me, new politics starts from this, and then you find the group of people and leaders that are going to be faithful to this vision and who have the track record to carry it out, together with, of course, the Filipino people. And that was the premise of the new politics. Not here, who's most popular so he can win, then he mouths a certain platform that's coming from nowhere. In the UN, this is not what will bring this country forward. That's why I framed in my letter, open letter, kay Noynoy before he decided that it will be a disservice if we avoid short-circuit the process of a national visioning process so as to align the highest aspirations of a nation towards a common focal point. That's why I started my whole thing with that. And then saying that, then you can now check my track record if I can actually bring this vision, create a reality out of it. That's the importance of a vision of the new politics.
How about the problems of our quarter?
The former traffic, settlers, yes.
Pollution, population.
Yes. Okay. We can talk about it from a structural perspective and a palliative perspective. The structural perspective would be we have an urbanization problem because we've failed in achieving equitable, broad-based economic development. That's what happens. We have, example, Metro Manila has 92% of the financial capital of the country. They're all focused here. It's all based in Metro Manila. Cebu has about 4 to 5%. And then the rest is distributed in all the urban centers. This might have changed with the emergence of Davao. But we need to have an economic development that allows the different regions of the Philippines to also develop, not just Metro Manila. And so then people will not keep on flocking to urban centers, and we will have a wonderful balance between urban and rural life. Get the best of the urban, get the best of the rural. I think that's the long-term structural approach, a broad-based economic development. Because if people remain poor, they will migrate to the cities and overload the city, the services capacity of the city, the water, the garbage, the pollution, all of this is as a result of people migrating and the traffic, the pollution. So we should be creating wide-scale opportunities in the countryside, as a kind of part of a strategic vision, and then in the meantime, in the near term, in the immediate term, if we want to relocate, let's say, I've spoken with leaders of urban groups, and I asked them, are you open to being relocated away from floodplains and living in riverbeds where you're going to be the first victims of another ondoy, especially in the age of climate change? It's interesting because I was just recently had a conversation with one of the ambassadors here, the British ambassador. He showed me a map that was done by the British government, and the Philippines is one of the hot spots of tropical cyclones and super typhoons. And this is already also well known with the Asian Development Bank study on climate change. So I was speaking with the urban leaders. Here's not the context. Ondoy is not an event that will happen in another 100 years. Probably in 2010, there might be another Ondoy. So, will you allow yourselves to be relocated to another area where it's safer? They all said yes. Under the provisions, number one, that they are consulted, and the place of relocation also is livelihood opportunities so that they're not just yakap and then at nowhere, and then they have no livelihood. That's why they came to Manila in the first place, to seek livelihood. So I think an integrated approach to the challenge of informal settlers, I think is doable. And some of this might require partnerships with private sector. For example, every time I see a cluttered lot in Manila owned by a private person who's probably cannot know what to deal with it. I can really see a mixed-use development there with the urban poor involved. So they don't actually have to migrate or to be resettled anywhere. You can provide together or the partnership of the person who owns the land, a building construction, and have terms that are affordable to the urban poor. And this can be achieved by consultation. We always have to think that when we're dealing with problems, we're dealing with human beings, with people with dignity, that whom we have to respect. And that's why for me, the fourth pillar that encompasses, that actually reaches out to the others, is this radical sense of openness of government, radical sense of true, genuine participation of people, especially the affected sectors, in government policies and government initiatives. And the same will happen with the question of the urban poor, or some people call them informal sectors. It's, I mean, can I just say a kind of like annotation? many of the solutions are clear. It's really clear. The question is the capability, the political will, and the intent to actually do it. Most of traditional politics is self-serving, has political ends, and using people as instruments to achieve political. At bottom, see people as the foundation for society, with genuine respect and genuine empowerment. This is how we will change this country authentically and with participation of the people.
So do you think poverty is caused by population or poverty?
Poverty.
And population.
So yes, it's become a kind of cycle, but I just had a kind of, a forum on poverty, population and environment. One of the things I pointed out there was one of the fastest ways to stabilize population and achieve sustainable population is broad-based economic equitable growth. In countries where per capita income increases across the board, the fertility rates go down. Because fertility rates are also, in a sense, a survival function. And so it's clear that the challenge of population and poverty are structural. And that's why we have to address systemic challenges and not just have technological fixes for population. We have to look at the substantive causes, the structural causes of both poverty and the population explosion, and address it at that level.
Other questions?
Okay.
I think you've answered something on environment really well.
Okay.
What in particular environmentalism are your plans regarding countries move versus climate change, I think said something like emission targets.
Right, okay. Emission targets in connection with climate change?
Yes.
Yes. I think as one of persons advocating for mitigation of greenhouse gases, I think we have to take a close look at three gases. It's not just carbon dioxide. We have to take a look at methane generation and also nitrous oxide generation. So if a structural approach to make our own contribution to the world. By the way, I must say this, that the Philippines is a minor contribution to the whole thing. But I feel that a sense of our oneness and our solidarity with humanity as a whole, we have to do our part in a way that is responsible and not disadvantageous to us. So in terms of greenhouse emissions that lead to climate change, the carbon targets are clear. The global target at the Copenhagen summit is, they actually are moving towards 400 parts per million and a little beyond. I think we should move towards 350 parts per million, which is the upper limit when we can destabilize the climate, number one. Number two, many have neglected methane. Methane emissions in this country are coming mostly from solid waste, the garbage. Metro Manila is 50 to 60% biological waste, and we're generating about 7,000 tons of waste a day. So can you imagine if you're able to properly dispose this, we actually reduce our methane emissions. And there's a wonderful technology, many people know this, this is the vermiculture technology. Worm castings are one of the richest sources of organic fertilizers, and you don't need large areas to compost 7,000 tons of or less than 5,000 tons of biological waste. The third source of major greenhouse gas emissions is agriculture. And this is not too well known, it's not too well discussed, but all over the world, about a third of greenhouse gas emissions are agriculture based through the use, massive use of chemical fertilizers. So I was mentioning to Ricky earlier, I'm going to be introducing organic farming in a nationwide scale, because among others, organic farming will cut down nitrous oxide emission. Nitrous oxide comes from the heavy usage of chemical nitrogen, especially urea, which is heavily used, yeah, fertilizer. Many people don't know that 1 ton of chemical fertilizer, urea, uses 5 tons of fossil fuels to manufacture. So you can imagine already the greenhouse contribution. Then once you put that thing on the soil, less than 10% is used. The rest of the 90% produce nitrous oxide, which is 200 times more destructive than carbon dioxide in terms of the greenhouse gas. Very few people know this. They're not even talking about it. That's why they say it's quaint organic farming. They found out in the United States, if organic farming was introduced in a nation scale, it will cut down the greenhouse gas emissions of the U.S. by one-third. I mean, that's massive. So we can do the same. We can do our share, and in fact, improve our ecology, improve our health, because we're eating a lot of junk food, which is actually also food with a lot of pesticides that we're eating without the proper monitoring. This is also one area that I'm going to beef up. I'm going to introduce the kinds of instruments that will allow us to monitor the kind of pesticide levels we're eating, because we're slowly killing ourselves as a people. Cancer rates are increasing in this country, diabetes rates, heart disease rates. But this is part of the overall approach. So the question is a kind of greenhouse emission. We're ending up with agriculture, lifestyle, consumption. This is all interrelated.
Organic vegetables right now are very expensive.
That doesn't have to be the case. In fact, when I was still producing and marketing organic vegetables, I told my staff, if something is very easy to grow without chemicals, just put a premium of like 5% on top of it. So if something is 10 pesos, sell it for 10.50. If something is 30, sell it for 31.50. But the others are like doubling, charging 100% or more. I think that doesn't have to be done. There's a success story here which I would like to highlight, because very few people know this. There's a little secret that I want you to know in connection with this. And I'm very happy with this story, because I actually helped the farmers who made this possible. There is a cooperative in Benguet. This cooperative of about 50 organic farmers, they set their price, is the same price throughout the year. And I know this because we buy vegetables from them. During Typhoon Ondoy, when some of the prices of the vegetables were ridiculously high, they maintained their price. They did not take advantage. It was organic, but lettuce, which was selling at 400, 500 pesos a kilo, was selling for them at 150 pesos a kilo.
So where can we find the profit?
No, exactly. That's why I'm announcing this. And would you know how to get in touch with them?
Latrinidad Traders, organic producers.
Okay. They are fantastic. I mean, we should really help them. I trained these farmers in the 1990s. I'm so happy that until today, they're still alive, functioning, and growing. I was the one who provided technical assistance to the leadership of this movement way back in the 1990s. The fact that they can then, they are not the type to take advantage of disasters like ongoing.
So they have branches here?
No. Yeah. We're actually planning to distribute the vegetables here. We're going to restart a kind of trading system, which will probably also help finance the campaign. So yun yung kayod. So anyway, but what I'm saying is that such farmers do exist. They are a large exception to the majority. Because for me, for example, it's ridiculous to sell alugbati. Do you know what alugbati is? You know, alugbati, this I was shocked, 120 pesos a kilo. Alugbati is like a weed. You can almost, it's so difficult to kill it. And you're selling it at 120 pesos a kilo. It can survive under flooding conditions. You know. Anyway, that's a whole other story. I can go on with it. Because that's my background, agriculture.
Growing up, three more questions.
Okay.
There's one more here online.
Sure.
What can we know about, what's your stand on the BFA?
BFA.
Or, versus profit.
Okay. First, I think the way it's being practiced now, I think that's to be stopped. There's a lot of violations of the Visiting Forces Agreement in here. And there are actual de facto violations of the Philippine Constitution, which they have tried to actually, increasing terms. There's some American soldiers that are getting involved in battle, not just training. There are all kinds of violations. So I think that's to be stopped. It has to be renegotiated. And in connection with this, we have to ask, the new government will ask the government of the United States, what is your geopolitical intent in this country? And we also have to be very clear, what is our geopolitical intent with the world? They do that too much. We will end the era that the Philippines is just a geopolitical pawn of any of the superpowers, whether it's China, which it has become under the Arroyo administration. I really have to point that out, because this ZTE, you cannot understand the ZTE deal, the South Rail, the North Rail, the investment of Chinese in mining, unless you understand that there was a geopolitical deal when Arroyo lost the support of the United States. We have to be proud of our own capacity to stand as a nation and negotiate on that basis, because we will continue to be the laughing stock of the world if we just become the ally. You know, I was so sad, GMA was so happy that she became the kind of spokesperson for ASEAN, for the United States. That's not an achievement at all. That just shows you how subservient we are to larger powers, because we cannot believe in our capacity to stand on our own self, but on our own feet. That's why for me, a prelude to foreign policy is to demonstrate that we can take care of our poverty, of our corruption, of our problems, so that when we negotiate on equal terms from one nation to another, not in a kind of instrumental fashion to make us the pawn or the instrument of larger powers because we need aid. I think it's a mendicant policy, shows a lack of belief in our capacity as a nation, and I'm going to put an end to that. On the other hand, since no nation is an island, if there are genuine needs for foreign relations, which there are, then it will be on the basis of mutual respect and mutual benefit. Not like this one-sided relationship that we have right now with the Visiting Forces Agreement. I'm not saying that there will be no relationship with the United States. What I'm saying is that we have to redefine the relationship of the United States with the U.S. on the basis of mutual respect and, you know, respect for our dignity as a country, and a clarity of what we want in the world.
Follow up.
Yeah.
Are you open to revisiting the Mutual Defense Treaty of 1950, the very first bilateral treaty?
I think as we move into the future, the geopolitical situation of the world is also moved. If you're going to sign a treaty with the United States, we have to sign it on the basis of actual conditions today and not use a past as a model, and reconceptualize the treaty on that basis. So for example, the 1950 treaty was clearly understood, and we were still under, although we were declared independent, we were not really independent of the United States. we were just one of the stepping ground. In fact, the Clark Air Base in the Subic Bay was the staging center of American presence in Africa and Asia. I mean, that was the context. We will redefine all of that. And we cannot go back to the past where we, in a sense, we were lackeys of the United States. We have to go back, we have to move forward to the future where we are a self-respecting nation wanting an equitable relationship, a really mutually beneficial relationship with another power.
There's another question about the labor sector.
Okay.
Ano ang posisyon ni Nicanor Perlas upos sa contractualization sa sektor ng mga manggagawa at handa ba niyang kilalanin ang right to strike bilang karapatan din ng mga manggagawa at pamahalaan?
Yes, yes to both. Yes to the right of workers to strike and to organize, and no to contractualization. I think we have to develop creative ways to actually ensure that we develop a kind of security of tenure of employees as long as they do not violate, they don't use it as, they don't use the tenure as a way to abuse. So there will be also a possibility for administrative cases of people who don't live up to their performance. So that it's not just a one-sided agreement, that the business interests are not also factored in. But to continue the practice of casualization like many malls are doing, I don't think it's, you know, every time I speak to the workers in the mall and different malls around the country, are you a casual up to 6 months and then you're replaced? And they say yes. And so I think the malls are really very rich. I mean, they're super rich. In fact, sometimes, anyway, I'm not going to describe the affluence anymore. They can actually afford to give people, employees, real possibility for promotions, engagement. Yeah.
Okay, so we have the last question. Anybody else would like to ask?
Will there be big catches in the Nicanor Perlas administration?
Definitely. No one is immune. The big fish will be caught. But there will be an attempt before to warn people that this is administration that will walk its talk. Because that's my part of my character. I don't say things and then I don't do it. And then I don't really believe in it. I mean, it's plastic. I mean, I'm not a plastic person. In the past, I've always said, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do this. So when I'm there in office, I'm going to warn people, if you violate the laws, the corruption, we will run after you. And there are no exceptions. In fact, I just want to state this, that people in my own campaign who thought I was that serious have actually been removed. In other words, if people thought that they were going to have favors because they help, that's not the case. I've always said, if you're supporting me, you're supporting a vision of this country. If you're giving financial resources, it's because you believe that this is the kind of leadership that will bring this country around. But if you expect that because you gave, you have the control over my soul, you're totally mistaken. So I'm not going to mention names or specific circumstances, but we have had to remove people in our own campaign who think like traditional and act, who think and act like traditional politicians. So that's why I know if I sit there and I've been saying this message, there's no personal favor in return for supporters. What will happen is that your dreams, the collective dream of this country, of your barangay, of your town, will be fulfilled. It benefits everybody.
Okay, we have Peter.
I'm Peter from Voice of the Youth Network. Sir, what are your plans to the youth?
Plans for?
Youth.
And the young people. Okay. This is of special interest to me, the young people, because I conduct a lot of training, education workshops for young people, not only in the Philippines, but all over the world. I really believe, in fact, for me, part of my own hope for this country is that there's a vast majority of young people in this country who are now going to vote, some of them for the first time, and some of them from the last election. Okay, so they enter there because it's kind of difficult to talk to elder people who have set ways, who have a lot of experience in traditional politics, and who have no belief in innovation. Young people are new. They are predisposed to challenge the existing system by their very nature. Young people are, by their very nature, are rebellious. In fact, I've told young people here, including leaders of young people of schools, that if a young person does not challenge the status quo or the system, that young person is very old. Because from day one, since you were in the womb of your parents, your mother, you're born to a family, you're raised in a school, blah, blah, you're totally conditioned. You have no choice of your own, you're shaped from the outside. You're basically an automaton. At some point, when conscious reflection comes in and critical thinking come in, you will have to ask the question, can you accept what was actually force-fed to you while you were growing up? And so it's natural for young people to ask radical questions. That's why most of our heroes are young people. Rizal was very young when he wrote Noli Mi Tangere, Pope Boniface, I mean, Jacinto, a lot of young people. So the young, by their very psychology, are predisposed to examine the status quo. And they have a lot of reasons to examine the status quo. And this is the message of new politics. That's why increasingly also then, young people are coming to be really interested in our campaign. But for the young people, we will actually develop opportunities for them to really enhance their leadership capacity, the capacity for critical thinking, improve choices in the curriculum of the schools to dialogue with the private sector. Most of the schools that we have today focus on skills, but very little critical thinking, capacity to reflect, philosophize, to really develop the higher centers of the brain and the human personality. And so there will be the National Youth Commission, for example, will be revitalized so that it will be depoliticized as an instrument of politics. This is what they've been doing, the National Youth Commission. The National Youth Commission will be totally strengthened to become the barrier of new impulses, not only in politics, but also in culture and business. And this is the way to engage young people in a meaningful participation in creating the future destiny of this country. So there will be a very strong support for young people in the new government.
Sir, I have other questions for disability people. Some of my friends, especially those that they have no work, but they have graduate naman sila ng college. If they sila makuha naman ng support for it. Ano po yung plan nyo sa kanila?
Ano mga people with differently abled? Okay. I've also been in dialogue with people who are differently abled. For example, there's the Saint, the College of Saint Benilde, for example, that have a lot of deaf, mute, basically deaf, right? Yeah. And there are potential partnerships. You know, it's interesting that, for example, if you're deaf, the brain compensates and develops an unusual capacity for your eyes. So, if people only use the scientific basis of compensation in the brain, because the brain is plastic in the sense that it can be compensated for any damage, then they can see that these people have special abilities, let's say in websites, in internet, and all of this, then they can be channeled there. We should remove a culture of automatic disqualification, and this will be achieved through education, through dialogue, through concrete partnerships, showing that the differently abled can be gainfully employed and treated with respect.
So, we have a lot of more questions that I think we should wrap up already.
Oh my God, holy smokes.
As a closing message for the electorate, what would you like to deliver to the online audience and to those internet users and how they can reach out to non-internet users also.
Yes. I think the for me the message that I've been spreading all over the country is that 2010 elections is not going to be an ordinary elections. It is going to be a very different election. And a lot is at stake in 2010. And a lot of Filipinos have waited for 2010 to truly express their sentiment for the Philippines. So I think let us all collectively make this one of the most conscious elections, if not the most conscious election in Philippine history. And now also in the age of the internet, in the age of bloggers and tweeters, it's definitely possible to do this. And I think, I mean, for me, I really believe that the bloggers have a major role in reflection. And I find, maybe this is a kind of bias, I find bloggers more open than conventional journalists in mainstream newspapers. So I would really encourage bloggers to maintain that independent stance of allowing Filipinos to really discern who really can lead this country into a renaissance, into a renewal, to express its highest possibilities. That is the key message, because in the end, it will not be one person, but all of us collectively awakening to hope for the best in this country, first during elections, and then after elections. Let's truly make this a functional democracy, one of the best in the world, because we really care for this country. Thank you.
Thank you for getting with us.
Yes. Thank you for having me again.
Yes. Yeah. We hope people will favor track record, character, over winability.
Yes.
And buhay yung new politics.
Salamat. Thank you. Wow.
Maybe we can
I think we should
eat first, no?
Yeah.
Before we picture
okay.
We almost had almost 1,800.
Yeah.
Wow.
There were more questions coming at the
end. Oh,
you're gonna die there. We are.
Yeah. No, great. Oh, really? Wow.
No, because it's night time.
Okay.
It was like a working day.
So that's significant. Yeah. Yeah, great. Thank you.
It's a clear in Dubai. I asked somebody from Dubai.
Yes, okay. Good. Good. Thanks.
Picture mo na.
Nagutom na. Kain ka! Nagutom. Sige, lasing ito. Nagutom na yan.